I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of June. The question of this hour is, why do so many African Americans still live in segregated ghettos in the country's metropolitan areas? Our guest says it was not the unintended effect of benign policies. It was an explicit, racially purposeful policy that was pursued at all levels of government. And that's why we have these ghettos today, and we are reaping the fruits of those policies. Joining us this hour is Richard Rothstein. He's research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. He has spent much time studying the history of residential segregation in America. He's the author of the report, The Making of Ferguson, also of Grading Education, Getting Accountability Right, and Class in Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap. Welcoming phone calls for him this hour, our number is 800-486-8645. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Richard, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. It's an important question that we really haven't asked very often. Let's describe first what a ghetto is and why you use that phrase, ghetto.
Well, the term ghetto describes a neighborhood, an area, which is racially or ethnically homogenous, and where exit is either prohibited or made very difficult, so where people are locked in. We have no difficulty talking about ghettos when we talk about Eastern European Jews who are locked into certain areas, not able to leave homogeneous areas. We get uncomfortable talking about ghettos today in this country because we want to forget about them. We want to avoid confronting the reality that every metropolitan area in this country has concentrations of disadvantaged African Americans living in neighborhoods where they were encircled for many years by public policy, and which it's very difficult now for them to leave.
And we've known about it. You remind us of Robert Weaver, the first African-American member of the cabinet appointed by President Johnson, who wrote a book in 1948 called The Negro Ghetto.
Yes. Well, the term ghetto was used commonly up until fairly recently when we've forgotten our racial history. It was commonly used in the Kerner Commission report, which was a report issued in 1968 after the riots that spread across the country, mostly in response to police killings of black men in 1967. Over 100 cities had riots like that at that time. It was once a common term of use, and it described, as I say, an encircled, homogenous neighborhood. And we're not going to solve these problems if we avoid talking about them and if we try to come up with euphemisms to avoid talking about things as they are.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let's go back to the creation of public housing in this country, when it happened, and how racial classification was used. These were segregated units.
Yes, public housing was one of them. As you mentioned a minute ago, these ghettos that we have today, the segregation that we have today throughout the metropolitan areas, was created by very explicit public policy. It was not the unintended consequence of benign policies, as you said. Public housing for civilians, that is not for military personnel, but public housing for civilians began during the New Deal in the early 1930s. And it was explicitly segregated. At the time, there was a big housing shortage in this country, and it was not only African-American families who lacked housing, but white families, white working and middle-class families who lacked housing. And public housing was the most desirable housing available for white lower-middle-class families. And the New Deal, the Public Works Administration, the New Deal began to build public housing across the country, and they built it on a segregated basis. There were projects for blacks, there were projects for whites. In many cases, integrated neighborhoods were demolished in order to create space for segregated public housing. The neighborhoods were demolished on the basis of the fact that they were slums, that the people were living in overcrowded conditions, and public housing was designed to give them better living standards. In cities all over the country, separate projects were built for blacks and whites by explicit federal policy. The Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior and in charge of the public housing program in the New Deal, established something he called a neighborhood composition rule, which was that public housing should be inhabited by people of the same race in the neighborhood where people of that race lived. Now, as I said, in fact, what they did was they demolished integrated neighborhoods in order to create segregated public housing. At the time, in the 1930s, many urban neighborhoods were integrated because workers had to live within working distance of the factories where they worked in downtown areas, and you couldn't have white workers living far out in the suburbs and away from their factories. So European immigrant groups, African Americans, Jews all lived in downtown areas, integrated areas, and those areas were often demolished in order to create public housing.
Mm. Eleanor Roosevelt was a good friend of Harold's. Didn't she say, wait a second, Harold, this isn't right?
No, actually the New Deal... it's an interesting point that you raised. The New Deal was relatively liberal on the question of race to the extent that they believed and argued that cities had to build public housing for blacks as well as for whites.
Hmm.
That was their focus. For example, in St. Louis, the center of the incident that started the current attention with the killings in Ferguson, in St. Louis, the city first proposed to build a whites-only public housing project in a neighborhood that had been integrated. The federal government intervened. The New Deal intervened and said, no, you can't do that. You have to build a public housing project for blacks as well. And so St. Louis eventually did. They built a black project and a white project. The black project was in the downtown area. The white project was further south. But that was the New Deal's emphasis, was to, and that's the way it won the allegiance of African Americans, because before they had nothing, now they at least had segregated something.
Yeah.
And, go on. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to move us into, we'll go back to this, but move us into the building of subdivisions starting in the 30s, right, and as you remind us, 40s and 50s, lots of places all over the country, and which gave builders concessionary loans through banks, lower interest rates for banks, and these subdivisions were built on the condition that no homes in those subdivisions be sold to African Americans?
Absolutely. This was the other major federal policy that resulted in the segregation of the metropolitan areas, beginning again in the 1930s with the establishment of the Federal Housing Administration. The federal government guaranteed loans to builders to create subdivisions, suburbs, mass production builders. And those loans were conditioned on the fact that no homes be sold to African Americans. You're familiar with, your listeners are familiar with many of these subdivisions. Many of them are not well known, but they exist in every metropolitan area. Levittown is probably the most famous in New York, outside New York City in Nassau County. Some of your listeners may recall a song that Pete Seeger used to sing about houses on a hillside made of ticky-tacky.
Yes.
That was about a big subdivision south of San Francisco that was also built with Federal Housing Administration guarantees on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans. So what happened was that as after World War II, this began during World War II, but it really stepped up after World War II, and then again even more after the Korean War, when building materials became available for the first time for civilian construction, the Federal Housing Administration financed these subdivisions. They suburbanized the white population, and whites began to have the option to move from public housing, which was, as I say, predominantly white at that time, from public housing into these segregated white subdivisions, leaving public housing as a blacks-only phenomenon that we come to associate with as being identical to public housing today. Of course, when that happened, when the Federal Housing Administration succeeded in suburbanizing the white population, industry moved as well. and that led to a much more impoverished black population left in the central cities. The other thing that happened is as whites left and the unemployed African Americans began to inhabit public housing because there were no jobs in the inner city, public housing authorities collected less rent, they spent less money on maintenance, and as a result, the condition of public housing deteriorated until they became vertical slums. And in St. Louis, which is the your listeners may recall the Pruitt-Igoe towers, which were iconic examples of slum vertical slums in housing, all black, dynamited by the federal government in 1972. They were originally built as two separate projects. Pruitt was for whites, Igoe was for blacks, and you have to forgive me, I might have reversed that, I've forgotten, but one was for whites, one was for blacks, and when whites were subsidized by the Federal Housing Administration to leave public housing and go to the suburbs, those developments then turned into all-black projects. There were long waiting lists initially for the black project. There were lots of vacancies in the white project as whites left for the suburbs, and eventually the St. Louis Housing Authority changed its policy and allowed blacks to move into the white project, and then it gradually became all white.
Mm-hmm.
When they dynamited the Pruitt-Igoe towers, and this, again, took place in every city, every metropolitan area in the country, the urban renewal, the redevelopment of downtown areas that had been home to African Americans, the federal government gave many of the residents of that public housing vouchers to move to subsidize their rents in private developments. But the vouchers weren't accepted throughout the metropolitan area. In St. Louis, they were accepted only in a few neighborhoods that adjoined the central city suburbs. Ferguson was one of them, and that's how Ferguson went from being an all-white, exclusively white community to an African-American one.
Interesting. So at what point was it, in terms of years, you talk about African-Americans managing to break out of these ghettos and buy a home in a neighboring area, and then what was used to persuade whites that they needed to leave because the ghetto was coming with these people, and by golly, this isn't good, and panic everybody. When did this happen? At what point in the century?
Well, it started shortly after World War II, after civilian housing construction picked up again, after materials became available for the civilian economy. And that's the point where urban renewal began, redevelopment, the demolition of slums, mostly often with explicit racial intent to clear downtown areas or areas near downtowns of African-American populations. We saw this, for example, in Chicago that some of your listeners may be familiar with, where Lake Meadows was built as a middle-class development on land that had previously been an African-American neighborhood. And African Americans were then forced out to other adjacent all African American neighborhoods. When you concentrate disadvantaged people in overcrowded conditions, and because African Americans, by the way, were prohibited from moving to most suburban areas, to white neighborhoods even in the cities, their housing choices were so constricted that demand for housing relative to supply was much greater than that of whites, and so African Americans paid much more for housing of similar quality than whites did in every metropolitan area. In order to make those rent payments or housing payments in ghetto areas, they frequently had to subdivide their homes or apartments and double up with other families because they were paying so much more than white families were paying for similar housing. And when you get that kind of overcrowding, you get deterioration in the neighborhood. Cities typically did not provide adequate services relative to the overcrowding of the population. Garbage was collected relatively less frequently in those neighborhoods, so they became slums. And then when African Americans were pushed out of those neighborhoods into adjoining neighborhoods that had been white, whites thought that they were going to bring slum conditions with them, thinking mm-hmm. that the slum conditions were characteristics of the families, not of the federal policies that had encircled them in those ghetto neighborhoods.
And real estate agents actually recruited blacks from the ghetto to walk around the neighborhood pushing baby carriages?
Well, yes. You're referring to a phenomenon called blockbusting. When African Americans were displaced or pushed, or if they pushed out of inner city neighborhoods, they would typically try to move to neighborhoods that just adjoined the ghetto, because that's the only place they could buy a home. Real estate agents, speculators, could make a killing by panicking whites, and what they did was they would try to convince whites in neighborhoods that their neighborhood was becoming a black slum, and they use a variety of techniques. One of them you mentioned is they would hire black women to push baby carriages around the neighborhood. They might hire black men to drive around the neighborhood blaring music. Sometimes they would randomly phone call people in the neighborhood asking for Johnny May or other stereotypical black names, and convincing whites that their neighborhood was going to become a slum, and they got the whites to sell their properties to these speculators, sell their homes at low prices. Blacks who needed housing desperately then paid very high prices for the same homes, and the speculators could turn these homes over fairly rapidly. There's a myth that property values go down when blacks move into a neighborhood. In fact, property values went way up because the housing supply for blacks was so constricted that speculators could charge very high prices for housing for blacks that whites wouldn't have to pay.
Well, welcome our conversation to listeners in just a moment. Richard Rothstein is our guest this hour, research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. Why do so many African Americans still live in segregated ghettos in the country's metropolitan areas? We're looking at the history this hour of the program, and a pretty one it is not. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Later in the hour, William Tisdale, Bill Tisdale, will be joining us, who for a long time has served as the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. They have recently filed with HUD a housing discrimination complaint against Fannie Mae, a very large owner of foreclosed homes in the United States, and we'll be looking at the results of their five-year investigation of properties maintained in white neighborhoods and not maintained in African American and Latino neighborhoods. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Richard Rothstein, research associate at the Economic Policy Institute, author of many books, and he has spent a good deal of time studying residential segregation in America. Ray in Rhinelander is our first caller. Richard, hi, Ray.
Hi. Thank you, Richard, for educating people on how housing structures were politically regulated back then. Also, I want to make a point. I was brought up in and around Milwaukee, and I want to be in defense of a lot of these black neighborhoods. The reason why at that time they were pretty good, and they had their little subdivisions within them of hierarchy as far as what people were doing with their jobs. But we had so many big major industries. We had A. O. Smith's, American Motors, Continental Banking, and we had so many small job shops that were all around that area. So I worked side by side when I was going to college. I worked in all these shops and places, and there were some fine families, and they had a lot of plans just like everybody else, and they were buying some of these houses. But when all these industries moved out, I mean, I saw the collapse by the week, by the month of that area. So not only did they have what you're talking about, they also had the job structure taken from underneath their feet that they solely depended upon. And it was horrible, and that's why the supposed ghettos got worse. And I'll take your comment off the air, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Ray.
Well, as I said earlier, you're absolutely right. And what happened was that white families, when these factories and job shops moved out to suburban areas, white workers could follow them. black workers were prohibited from doing so. And so it exacerbated the inequalities between blacks and whites and that we're still living with today.
Stephen on Facebook writes and asks this question, did the interstate highway system built through cities exacerbate the problem of inner city poverty?
Yes, it did, and it also exacerbated the problem of segregation. Many of the highways that were built through the cities were explicitly, and I want to emphasize again, explicitly, this was not an unintended consequence of race-neutral policies, explicitly routed to demolish black ghettos that were too close to downtown for white businessmen's comfort. And that was, you go through some cities in this country and these interstate highways take circuitous routes through the cities. If you want to know why they're taking those routes, just look at what the racial maps were like before the interstate highway system was built. In some cases, interstate highway systems were routed to create a barrier between black and white neighborhoods so that African Americans couldn't easily leave the ghetto and try to find housing outside it. The Dan Ryan Expressway that runs through the south side of Chicago was one of those barriers built to separate black and white neighborhoods. So the interstate highway system was part of this. It was a racially conscious design on the part of those who wrote the interstate highway bill, the highway bill during the Eisenhower administration in 1956, I believe, that the bill was passed. This was explicit on the part of the people who were considering the bill. It was a way to get rid of the Negroes in the downtown areas.
Where did all the displaced people go?
Well, they went to places as the place that people are most familiar now with is Ferguson. They went to the next neighborhood farther out as they were displaced, and the ghetto expanded in that direction as the more downtown areas were filled in by highway interchanges and hospitals and universities, mm-hmm. Downtown businesses, some middle-class housing. All of that was done on the site of former African-American neighborhoods, and the black population had to move a little bit farther out. And that's how it gave rise to the blockbusting that we described before in the adjacent neighborhoods.
And that's
in St. Louis, for example. Go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, in St. Louis, for example, which, again, I talk about only because so much attention was paid to it because of Ferguson. In St. Louis, you're all familiar, I'm sure, your listeners are familiar with the Gateway Arch, the symbol of the gateway to the west.
Mm-hmm.
That arch, the park that surrounds it, that whole downtown area, is on the site of a former vibrant African-American neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was all demolished in order to create the symbol of the west. And the people who lived there had to go somewhere, and they went to the next neighborhoods farther north, farther west, and those then became the relocated ghettos.
Al is joining us from Land O'Lakes. Hi, Al.
Hi. Good show, guys.
Thanks.
I knew Father Grappi. My dad was his dentist, and he was the Grappi family dentist. I was actually at his ordination when I was a little kid.
Hmm.
And then I was also at the 16th Street Viaduct when they tried to integrate the south side of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The reason I'm calling is my grandson, he can't comprehend this hate. Seven. And I saw it there. And it's not going to stop. You know, I recommend everybody to see that movie, Power, Money, and the American Dream. It's Park Avenue. And it explains it. They're trying to enslave people. And then Paul Ryan tried to eliminate low-income housing in his budget when him and Mitch were running for office. You know, thank God they didn't get in. Anyway, it's a great show.
Thank you very much for the call. It is, I mean, we're seeing evidence of it in everywhere, and maybe paying attention when we have horrors like what happened in Charleston, but Al makes an interesting point. It's just hard to imagine the kind of hate that is behind so many of these policies.
Well, you're right, and there is hate that's behind the policies, but it's easy to blame the conflicts that we have and the racial divisions that we have and the inequality that we have on hate, because there's not much that we can do about hate. But What we ignore is that without public policy that was racially explicit, designed with the explicit purpose of segregating our metropolitan areas, this hate wouldn't have had a fertile ground to plow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the public policy that we need to focus on, because that's something we can do about. If we think that the reason we have segregation is because people like to live with each other of the same race, or there was private prejudice, or there was hatred, well, it's very hard to think of things we can do about it. But if we recognize that the segregation that we have in this country was the result of purposeful racial policy, then we can come to understand that purposeful policy can also reverse it. And there are tools that we can use to desegregate our metropolitan areas and ameliorate some of the problems that we're suffering from today.
Well, I'm broadcasting from one of the most racially segregated places in the country, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yes.
How would you propose that we enact purposeful policy to lessen the extreme segregation in this area?
Well, there are some very short-term moderate policies that we could use, and then there are much longer-term ones, which I think we would understand the necessity of once we become familiar again with the history of public segregation. The short-term policies are fairly easy. You know, we have two federal policies now that are designed to support housing for low- and moderate-income families. One is a tax credit that's issued by the Department of the Treasury. It's called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It's given to developers who agree to set aside a small proportion of the units in every development that they build for low- and moderate-income families. Those developments and the tax credits are now issued to developers, predominantly to build developments in already segregated low-income neighborhoods. They're reinforcing and enhancing segregation rather than doing the reverse. We could very easily change the way we administer the low-income housing tax credit policy to require developers to use those tax credits in high-opportunity neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
so that we get some integration. The other major federal policy we have today is the Section 8 housing voucher program, which is a program for lower-income families. The tax credit program I mentioned before was not just for the lowest-income families. The Section 8 voucher program gives vouchers to families to help subsidize their rent so they can afford to move into private apartments. That program as well is used to it gives vouchers to families who predominantly are able to use them only in already segregated low-income neighborhoods. As I mentioned before, when the ghettos in central St. Louis were demolished, the federal government gave many of the displaced residents Section 8 vouchers, but the only places they could use them were in homogeneous segregated communities, or new communities that became segregated because they were adjacent to the ghetto. Families displaced from the central city of St. Louis couldn't use those vouchers in the suburbs of St. Louis, in the white suburbs of St. Louis. Landlords wouldn't take them. We could prohibit that kind of refusal. We could redesign the Section 8 housing voucher program so those vouchers were only used and only could be used in unsegregated, not highly concentrated areas of poverty. So those are two very short-term policies that would be easy to adjust if we wanted to use them to desegregate.
Mm-hmm. And the effects of segregation extend to our schools, don't they? I know you have written a great deal and written books about schools. You look at how segregated schools are in this area and in various cities throughout the country, and they're poor and they're mostly minority, and there are a whole host of problems that in some ways result from the very issue that we've been talking about, segregated housing.
Well, in all ways they result from that. In fact, as you mentioned, I used to write and research almost exclusively about education, and I soon came to realize that there's no way we're going to solve the education problems of this country in segregated schools. When you have a few children in a classroom who have serious social and economic problems, who come to school hungry or who've come to school stressed because they've experienced or witnessed violence or any number of other reasons that low-income children, disadvantaged children, don't do well in school. A few children in a classroom, a teacher can pay special attention to those children and try to overcome some of their social and economic difficulties that they bring to school. When you have whole classrooms filled with children with those kinds of problems, obviously a teacher can't pay special attention to everyone, and so the level of instruction declines. You spend much more time on remediation and less on grade level instruction. You have more children acting out because of the stress that they're coming to school with, and more discipline, less instruction. So you can't raise the achievement significantly of children in segregated communities, attending segregated schools. The only way to accomplish the goals that we have of education, of providing equal educational outcomes for all children, is to desegregate schools. And we can't desegregate schools without desegregating neighborhoods, because the main reason why schools are segregated is because they're located in segregated neighborhoods.
Let's go to Connie L. Thanks for your call. Connie in Madison. Hi.
Hi, I checked into the program only at the point where you were talking about the interstate highways coming through in a very conscious and purposeful way. And I would like you to replace the word ghetto with the word neighborhood, because so often these were vibrant neighborhoods. I'm thinking of a wonderful writer named Mindy Thompson Fullilove. Her name is Odd, Fullilove. She wrote a book called Root Shock, and she is a psychiatrist by training, but she studied essentially the sociology of what happens and what happened particularly in both Newark and Pittsburgh with urban renewal projects, the things that are not tangible that are lost in much the same way that the root hairs when you transplant a plant are lost, the very tiny fibers that connect. She makes that extended metaphor that connects people and gives people functioning businesses to see and professionals to use. This is the point. And another book that she wrote called The House of Joshua, I just want to read three sentences and then I'll hang up for thoughts. She says, and I'll excerpt them, all places are assigned to people and all people are assigned to places. In making place assignments, those in power can take as much space as well as the best quality space as they can. The odd planning strategy of displacing the poor without regard for where they will go makes sense only in a model of the politics of place that assumes the poor are not entitled to a place. People need a place in order to live. To deny place is to deny life. She's a worthwhile writer, and she's not new. This is from the late 1990s, but I find her work very valuable on the way that functioning black neighborhoods are not in front of our eyes anymore. Which is not an accident, and it's not the fault of, it's not coming out of some intrinsic flaw in black culture. I'd love some comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Connie. Thank you. Richard.
Well, I spoke at the beginning of the program about why we should not abandon the word ghetto. It's too easy to ignore the way in which public policy has encircled black communities and kept black families from areas of opportunity. So I think I talked about that earlier before your caller tuned in. You know, I'll give you an example, if I may, of how these kinds of policies endured. I mentioned earlier all the subdivisions that were created by the Federal Housing Administration on a whites-only basis. Take Levittown, but the same thing is true in the suburbs of Milwaukee and Chicago and St. Louis and Detroit and Cleveland, and you go on and on. Those homes in Levittown in 1947-48 were sold for about $7,000 apiece. In today's terms, that's $125,000. Those homes today sell for $500,000 or $600,000.
Oh, my goodness.
The white families who working-class families. These are not the middle-class families. These are working-class families, returning war veterans, who were able to buy into Levittown on a racially exclusive basis in the early 1950s, late 1940s, and pay $125,000 for them, gained over the course of the next couple of generations, those families gained $300,000, $400,000 in equity. Most of the wealth that American families, middle-class families, have today is from their investments in their housing, from the equity they have in their homes. black families who were denied that opportunity and had to continue to live in ghettos in places like Harlem or other areas in New York City that were open to African-American residents, gained none of that equity appreciation. The result is that today, on average, and I'm talking about a national average now, African-American families have about 60% of the income on average as white families. This is the money they earn from working
from working.
60% of their income, 60% of white income is the average income of black families. But for black wealth, they have 5% of the wealth of white families on average. That difference, and that's an enormous difference, between 60% of white incomes on average and 5% of white wealth on average is entirely attributable to federal public policy, federal housing policy that was racially exclusive. And if you want to know why African Americans can't now afford to move to suburbs where the homes now sell for $500,000 or $600,000, you need to understand this history. It doesn't do much good to pass a fair housing law, as we've done in 1968, that says, okay, black families, you're now free to move to Levittown or to Daly City in California or Lakewood or any of the other subdivisions like that around the country. Those homes are now unaffordable to working class and lower middle class families. So I mentioned earlier you wanted public policies. I mentioned some very modest things we could do with the low-income housing tax credit and the Section 8 voucher program. But we haven't even begun to think about how we remedy this theft.
Yes.
Of the opportunity to acquire wealth from several generations of black families that would enable them to move into middle-class communities. And, of course, the wealth that the white families gained that was denied to black families was used to send children to college, to launch them into professional careers, usually to provide secure retirements for working-class white families so that their children didn't have to divert their own incomes to support their parents and their grandparents. The consequences, the enduring consequences of these federal policies are enormous, and we haven't even begun to think about how we can remedy them.
That's a huge problem to remedy. We're going to continue. If you're on hold, please stay where you are. We want to introduce Bill Tisdale to the conversation here in just one moment to talk specifically about what's going on in the Milwaukee area and the latest filing with HUD of housing discrimination complaints against Fannie Mae, one of the largest owners of foreclosed homes in the United States. We'll continue your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let me just read this message from Arlene before we soon introduce Bill. I grew up in Levittown, Pennsylvania between 1956 and 1969. I recall when the first black family moved into one of the subdivisions and there were calls for rioting and brick throwing. My dad, who was a real Archie Bunker at the time, wanted to participate. My mother was the only reason he did not. That was a very scary event. When I was 12 years old, it was the beginning of my understanding of how terrible that new family must have felt and how difficult it must have been. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard Rothstein remains with us, research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. He has studied segregation in schools and residential segregation in America. We wanted to spend a few moments as well with Bill Tisdale, who has served as the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council for more than 35 years, which is pretty amazing. I haven't talked to Bill in many years. 35 years now, Bill. That's a while, huh?
Actually, Kathleen, it was 37.
Oh, my gosh.
On the 19th of this month.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you have quite a history to share with us as well. But let's start with this housing discrimination complaint that was filed against Fannie Mae.
Well, the Fannie Mae complaint was one of several that we filed with HUD, alleging differences in treatment, basically discriminatory activities based on race. In the real estate market, which pertains specifically to what we call REOs, which are real estate-owned properties. These are properties that are still in the portfolios, in many instances, of the lending institutions that mortgaged them. The companies that were involved in this were Wells Fargo initially, U.S. Bank, Bank of America and then Fannie Mae. So Fannie Mae is the last of those that has been brought into the mix here as far as discriminatory housing practices as to how the units that they own or service are marketed. And basically by that we mean what do the properties look like when they are in foreclosure? So we have found that in neighborhoods, how they're maintained makes a big difference. So the neighborhoods, housing that's located in the African-American neighborhoods, predominantly African-American or integrated neighborhoods, seem to have more weeds, gutters are in disrepair, porches are in disrepair, windows are broken, for sale signs are not visible, electrical meters are exposed, wiring's exposed, trash in the yards, mail is not picked up, missing gutters, while that same lender having properties in white neighborhoods, you wouldn't even know the properties were foreclosed. The grass is cut. The mail is picked up. A clear for sale sign. Porches are in repair. Roofs are in repair. So when we're looking at this, we kind of get the picture that these homes in African-American and integrated neighborhoods aren't as important to these lenders, and that was what we proposed to them. Why are the houses maintained in one area of the city different, look entirely different, yes, and are maintained entirely differently than those in white neighborhoods? And that was for all of these lenders. Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank both settled the complaints earlier and have been moving what we consider in the right direction as far as getting some type of balance between how homes maintained in one area of the community are maintained equally in another area.
Mm-hmm. And as you remind us, it's certainly if you've got all these problems with grass and trash and windows broken, et cetera, will only add to a destabilization of the communities that have been the hardest hit by foreclosures.
Absolutely. You know, the problem is many of these homes that were foreclosed and looked like this, like I had described, were next to homes that were beautifully maintained. So the neighbors in those neighborhoods were complaining, you know, they in some cases had to shovel the snow. They in some cases had to mow the lawns of these foreclosed properties that were owned by these lending institutions. They were suffering. Their property values were being reduced, were diminished. The whole area, the quality of life is changed based on how these properties were maintained. And so that's a major problem, too. We're talking about neighborhood stabilization. We're also talking about quality of life. These individuals have put a lot of investment into making their homes livable, their neighborhoods wonderful, and getting along with neighbors and socializing. And then you have a foreclosed home boarded up that looks like it's something out of a World War II movie.
Right. You've also, we've been talking about the history of segregated housing. You've also been working 37 years now on fair housing issues in the city of Milwaukee. When you look at your own historical perspective, Bill, you're still fighting a lot of these battles, but are there improvements here, or do you find that what we've been talking about, that people are just stuck in ghettos in this city, and for reasons that we've discussed and maybe you want to add to, the situation isn't much better than when you first started at the Fair Housing Council?
You know, I would say that things have improved. However, we still have an enormous amount of discrimination occurring, and I think that's one of the major factors, as Richard, I think, will agree, for segregated housing patterns, discrimination. One of the issues that we are very concerned about is that discrimination has kind of taken a new face, and we've been talking about that for some time, but that still persists. It's not the situation necessarily where African-Americans, Latinos, persons with disabilities, veterans go to places and are told, we don't want you living here. It's more kind of easily and smoothly and politely revolved out of the system. So they're told there's a waiting list or there's some other types of reference checks that need to be made. In the case of lending, lenders, in many instances, we found that the files for individuals applying for mortgages, white individuals, their files are gigantic. I mean, they're like an inch or two thick. all of the types of things, getting them ready, preparing them, sending them to the homebuyer clinics, pre-purchase counseling, all of those things, whereas an equally qualified African-American family may have, like, you know, two or three pages on theirs. You know, your credit's not good. You better get it fixed before you even think about applying for a loan. So we see differences in treatment at various levels where people themselves are put on the spot. They're put in a position as, you know, maybe I'm not doing something right. And it's not necessarily that. It's that the people who are the gatekeepers, the lending institutions, the insurance companies, real estate concerns, landlords at various levels, whether they're mom and pop or some major corporation running the business, they're putting people in the position of not knowing exactly what the eligibility requirements are. So people are thinking, well, maybe my credit isn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a white person who doesn't have good credit, then they're sent to some homebuyer counseling and preparation so that they can get it in place. African Americans may not be afforded that same information, and that's where the discrimination occurs, and that's how it looks today. That's contemporary discrimination. It's not necessarily somebody saying, you know, get out, we don't want you here. It's you don't quite qualify, or you haven't worked long enough, or you need several references, or you need to know someone who already lives in this unit or this
right.
complex or this subdivision. And those are the types of things that African Americans, Latinos, other minorities face now.
Mm-hmm. Richard remains with us. I want to get a couple more callers if we can. Carl in Madison, thanks for waiting.
Yes, I had a question, but just listening to these two gentlemen and their various expertise lay a map out where you sort of say this gentleman who shot up this church in Carolina, and we recoil, of course, at that. And then you look at these policies that redouble poverty and recircle people back on their, you know, just fall back against any effort to try to get ahead. And these are inscribed in law and written and unwritten practices. And I'd like to say just getting this information out there is going to, you know, boy, we know, and let's stop with the stereotypes and let's get about fixing this. But we slide so easily back into those stock answers that remove any burden from ourselves and mm-hmm. place it back on the people at the bottom. But I do commend these gentlemen in this show for at least opening some eyes as to the severity of the headwind that these people that have every right to be American citizens are facing, and the policies that lead to such horrific situations that, you know, we're seeing in the news. I'm just flabbergasted.
I am too. Thanks, Carl, for your call. Richard, your response, and then Bill.
Well, just briefly, I agree that getting the information out, re-educating people about this history, which was once, by the way, well known, is very important. But, of course, re-education is a first step. We need to do something about our new understandings once we understand them. But I think that we have so suppressed our knowledge of this history. And as I say, it was once well known. It was spoken about by politicians, by leaders, about how the public policy has encircled the neighborhoods. When George Romney, who was the President Nixon's Secretary of HUD, he described how federal government had created a white noose around black neighborhoods, and he said it was time for the federal government to untie that noose. Well, nothing was done. But it was once well known. He could say that. A Republican Secretary of Housing and Urban Development could make a statement like that, and nobody would think twice about it. Today, we've forgotten that history completely. So before we can address these problems, we need to remember and relearn the history that we have so thoroughly suppressed.
Right. Bill.
You know, Richard and I think other callers have mentioned and alluded to this before. These acts that we're talking about, these are conscious and deliberate. These aren't accidental or incidental. I was talking with a civil rights worker several years ago who described this like a coat hanger. It takes effort to bend the coat hanger down, but it also takes that effort to reconstruct it so it looks somewhat like it did before. So there's got to be political will. There's got to be more than talk, more than focus groups, more than newspaper articles. We have to take this on as an issue that needs to be addressed. This is important an issue as any public policy issue that exists. Housing, where people live. Where they live decides where they go to school, what kinds of jobs they have, what kind of quality of life they have, how close they are to health care delivery services. All of these things are inextricably linked, and you can't deal with one outside of the other. Transportation, all of those things are bound together, and we can't separate them and work on them in pieces as elected officials in many instances attempt to do. This is a compound problem, and it's going to take the entire community getting some guts, and I'm using the word guts instead of the other, using some guts to move forward and take action to make sure these things don't continue to happen. And they are continuing to happen, and there's no equity. There is no equity. All the information that Richard's provided to you about the historical balance and the historical activities, all that's still happening today. It just happens in some instances in many in different forms. So I agree, we've got to do something, but we can't be the only ones doing it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both very much for being with us. Bill, it was nice to talk to you again. 37 years, more power to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Bill Tisdale, for 37 years, served as the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. Richard Rothstein, thanks for reminding us of our history, which we should have known, but we need to be reminded. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Rothstein, with us, the research associate of the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks to Scott Myers for producing this hour and for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up.